This Side of Paradise by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Book One. The Romantic Egotist. Chapter One. Amory, Son of Beatrice. Part One. Amory Blaine inherited from his mother every trait, except the stray inexpressible few that made him worthwhile. His father, an ineffectual, inarticulate man with a taste for Byron and a habit of drowsing over the Encyclopaedia Britannica, grew wealthy at 30 through the death of two elder brothers, successful Chicago brokers, and in the first flush of feeling that the world was his, went to Bar Harbor and met Beatrice O'Hara. In consequence, Stephen Blaine handed down to posterity his height of just under 6 feet and his tendency to waver at crucial moments, these two abstractions appearing in his son Amory. For many years he hovered in the background of his family's life, an unassertive figure with a face half obliterated by lifeless silky hair, continually occupied in taking care of his wife, continually harassed by the idea that he didn't and couldn't understand her. But Beatrice Blaine, there was a woman. Early pictures taken on her father's estate at Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, or in Rome at the Sacred Heart Convent, an educational extravagance that in her youth was only for the daughters of the exceptionally wealthy, showed the exquisite delicacy of her features, the consummate art and simplicity of her clothes. A brilliant education she had. Her youth had passed in Renaissance glory. She was versed in the latest gossip of the older Roman families, known by name as a fabulously wealthy American girl to Cardinal Vittori and Queen Margherita, and more subtle celebrities that one must have had some culture even to have heard of. She learned in England to prefer whiskey and soda to wine, and her small talk was broadened in two senses during a winter in Vienna. All in all, Beatrice O'Hara absorbed the sort of education that will be quite impossible ever again, a tutelage measured by the number of things and people one could be contemptuous of and charming about, a culture rich in all the arts and traditions, barren of all ideas, in the last of those days when the great gardener clipped the inferior roses to produce one perfect bud. In her less important moments she returned to America, met Stephen Blaine, and married him. This almost entirely because she was a little bit weary, a little bit sad. Her only child was carried through a tiresome season and brought into the world on a spring day in 96. When Amory was 5, he was already a delightful companion for her. He was an auburn-haired boy with great handsome eyes, which he would grow up to in time, a facile, imaginative mind, and a taste for fancy dress. From his 4th to his 10th year, he did the country with his mother in her father's private car, from Coronado, where his mother became so bored that she had a nervous breakdown in a fashionable hotel, down to Mexico City, where she took a mild, almost epidemic consumption. This trouble pleased her, and later she made use of it as an intrinsic part of her atmosphere, especially after several astounding bracers. So while more or less fortunate little rich boys were defying governesses on the beach at Newport, or being spanked or tutored or read to from Do and Dare or Frank on the Mississippi, Amory was biting acquiescent bell-boys in the Waldorf, outgrowing a natural repugnance to chamber music and symphonies, and deriving a highly specialized education from his mother. "Amory?" "Yes, Beatrice." Such a quaint name for his mother, she encouraged it. "Dear, don't think of getting out of bed yet. I've always suspected that early rising in early life makes one nervous. Clotilde is having your breakfast brought up." "All right." "I am feeling very old today, Amory," she would sigh, her face a rare cameo of pathos, her voice exquisitely modulated, her hands as facile as Bernhardt's. "My nerves are on edge, on edge. We must leave this terrifying place tomorrow and go searching for sunshine." Amory's penetrating green eyes would look out through tangled hair at his mother. Even at this age, he had no illusions about her. "Amory," Oh, yes? I want you to take a red-hot bath, as hot as you can bear it, and just relax your nerves. You can read in the tub if you wish. She fed him sections of the Fête Galante before he was 10. At 11 he could talk glibly, if rather reminiscently, of Brahms and Mozart and Beethoven. One afternoon, when left alone in the hotel at Hot Springs, he sampled his mother's apricot cordial, and as the taste pleased him, he became quite tipsy. This was fun for a while, but he essayed a cigarette in his exultation, and succumbed to a vulgar, plebeian reaction. Though this incident horrified Beatrice, it also secretly amused her, and became part of what in a later generation would have been termed her line. "This son of mine," he heard her tell a room full of awestruck, admiring women one day, "is entirely sophisticated and quite charming, but delicate. We're all delicate. Here, you know." Her hand was radiantly outlined against her beautiful bosom. Then, sinking her voice to a whisper, she told them of the apricot cordial. They rejoiced, for she was a brave raconteuse, but many were the keys turned in sideboard locks that night against the possible defection of little Bobby or Barbara. These domestic pilgrimages were invariably in state. Two maids, the private car, or Mr. Blaine when available, and very often a physician. When Amory had the whooping cough, four disgusted specialists glared at each other hunched around his bed. When he took scarlet fever, the number of attendants, including physicians and nurses, totaled 14. However, blood being thicker than broth, he was pulled through. The Blaines were attached to no city. They were the Blaines of Lake Geneva. They had quite enough relatives to serve in place of friends, and an enviable standing from Pasadena to Cape Cod. But Beatrice grew more and more prone to like only new acquaintances, as there were certain stories, such as the history of her constitution and its many amendments, memories of her years abroad, that it was necessary for her to repeat at regular intervals. Like Freudian dreams, they must be thrown off, else they would sweep in and lay siege to her nerves. But Beatrice was critical about American women, especially the floating population of ex-Westerners. "They have accents, my dear," she told Amory. "Not Southern accents or Boston accents. Not an accent attached to any locality. Just an accent." She became dreamy. "They pick up old, moth-eaten London accents that are down on their luck and have to be used by someone. They talk as an English butler might after several years in a Chicago Grand Opera Company." She became almost incoherent. "Suppose, time in every Western woman's life, she feels her husband is prosperous enough for her to have accent. They try to impress me, my dear." Though she thought of her body as a mass of frailties, she considered her soul quite as ill, and therefore important in her life. She had once been a Catholic, but discovering that priests were infinitely more attentive when she was in the process of losing or regaining faith in Mother Church, she maintained an enchantingly wavering attitude. Often she deplored the bourgeois quality of the American Catholic clergy, and was quite sure that had she lived in the shadow of the great continental cathedrals, her soul would still be a thin flame on the mighty altar of Rome. Still, next to doctors, priests were her favourite sport. "Ah, Bishop Whiston," she would declare, "I do not want to talk of myself. I can imagine the stream of hysterical women fluttering at your doors, beseeching you to be simpatico." Then, after an interlude filled by the clergyman, "But my mood is oddly dissimilar." Only to bishops and above did she divulge her clerical romance. When she had first returned to her country, there had been a pagan Swinburnian young man in Asheville, for whose passionate kisses and unsentimental conversations she had taken a decided penchant. They had discussed the matter pro and con with an intellectual romancing quite devoid of sappiness. Eventually she had decided to marry for background, and the young pagan from Asheville had gone through a spiritual crisis, joined the Catholic Church, and was now Monsignor Darcy. "Indeed, Mrs. Blaine, he is still delightful company, quite the cardinal's right-hand man." "Amory will go to him one day, I know," breathed the beautiful lady, "and Monsignor Darcy will understand him as he understood me." Amory became 13, rather tall and slender, and more than ever on to his Celtic mother. He had tutored occasionally, the idea being that he was to keep up, at each place, taking up the work where he left off. Yet as no tutor ever found the place he left off, his mind was still in very good shape. What a few more years of this life would have made of him is problematical. However, 4 hours out from land, Italy-bound, with Beatrice, his appendix burst, probably from too many meals in bed, and after a series of frantic telegrams to Europe and America, to the amazement of the passengers, the great ship slowly wheeled round and returned to New York to deposit Amory at the pier. You will admit that if it was not a life, it was magnificent. After the operation, Beatrice had a nervous breakdown that bore a suspicious resemblance to delirium tremens, and Amory was left in Minneapolis, destined to spend the ensuing 2 years with his aunt and uncle. There the crude, vulgar air of Western civilization first catches him, in his underwear, so to speak. A Kiss for Amory. His lip curled when he read it. "I am going to have a bobbing party," it said, "on Thursday, December the 17th, at 5 o'clock, and I would like it very much if you could come. Yours truly, RSVP, Myra St. Clair." He had been 2 months in Minneapolis, and his chief struggle had been the concealing from the other guys at school how particularly superior he felt himself to be. Yet this conviction was built upon shifting sands. He had shown off one day in French class—he was in senior French class—to the utter confusion of Mr. Reardon, whose accent Amory damned contemptuously, to the delight of the class. Mr. Reardon, who had spent several weeks in Paris 10 years before, took his revenge on the verbs whenever he had his book open. But another time Amory showed off in history class, with quite disastrous results. For the boys there were his own age, and they shrilled innuendos at each other all the following week. "Aw, I believe, don't you know, the American Revolution was largely an affair of the middle classes," or "Washington came of very good blood, aw, quite good, I believe." Amory ingeniously tried to retrieve himself by blundering on purpose. 2 years before he had commenced a history of the United States which, though it only got as far as the colonial wars, had been pronounced by his mother completely enchanting. His chief disadvantage lay in athletics, but as soon as he discovered that it was the touchstone of power and popularity at school, he began to make furious, persistent efforts to excel in the winter sports, and with his ankles aching and bending in spite of his efforts, he skated valiantly around the Lorelei rink every afternoon, wondering how soon he would be able to carry a hockey stick without getting it inexplicably tangled in his skates. The invitation to Miss Myra St. Clair's bobbing party spent the morning in his coat pocket, where it had an intense physical affair with a dusty piece of peanut brittle. During the afternoon he brought it to light with a sigh, and after some consideration and a preliminary draft in the back of Collar and Daniel's first-year Latin, composed an answer. "My dear Miss Sinclair, your truly charming invitation for the evening of next Thursday evening was truly delightful to receive this morning. I will be charmed and enchanted indeed to present my compliments on next Thursday evening. Faithfully, Amory Blaine." On Thursday, therefore, he walked pensively along the slippery, shovel-scraped sidewalks, and came in sight of Myra's house, on the half-hour after 5, a lateness which he fancied his mother would have favoured. He waited on the doorstep with his eyes nonchalantly half-closed, and planned his entrance with precision. He would cross the floor, not too hastily, to Mrs. Sinclair, and say with exactly the correct modulation, "My dear Mrs. Sinclair, I'm frightfully sorry to be late, but my maid—" He paused there and realized he would be quoting. "But my uncle and I had to see a fella. Yes, I've met your enchanting daughter at dancing school." Then he would shake hands, using that slight, half-foreign bow, with all the starchy little females, and nod to the fellas who would be standing round paralyzed into rigid groups for mutual protection. A butler, one of the three in Minneapolis, swung open the door. Amory stepped inside and divested himself of cap and coat. He was mildly surprised not to hear the shrill squawk of conversation from the next room. He decided it must be quite formal. He approved of that, as he approved of the butler. "Miss Myra?" he said. To his surprise, the butler grinned horribly. "Oh, yeah," he declared. "She's here." He was unaware that his failure to be Cockney was ruining his standing. Amory considered him coldly. "But," continued the butler, his voice rising unnecessarily, "she's the only one what is here. The party's gone." Amory gasped in sudden horror. "What?" "She's been waiting for Amory Blaine. That's you, ain't it? Her mother says that if you showed up by 5:30, you two was to go after him in the Packard." Amory's despair was crystallized by the appearance of Myra herself, bundled to the ears in a polo coat, her face plainly sulky, her voice pleasant only with difficulty. "'Lo, Amory.' "'Lo, Myra.' He had described the state of his vitality. "'Well, you got here anyways.' "'Well, I'll tell you. I guess you don't know about the auto accident,' he romanced. Myra's eyes opened wide. "'Who was it to?' "'Well,' he continued desperately, "'Uncle and Aunt and I. Was anyone killed?' Amory paused and then nodded. "'Your uncle?' Alarm. "'Oh, no, just a horse. A sort of gray horse.' At this point the Erse butler snickered. "'Probably killed the engine,' he suggested. Amory would have put him on the rack without a scruple. "'We'll go now,' said Myra coolly. "'You see, Amory, the bobs were ordered for five, and everybody was here, so we couldn't wait.' "'Well, I couldn't help it, could I? So Mama said for me to wait till 5:30. We'll catch the bobs before it gets to the Minnehaha Club, Amory.' Amory's shredded poise dropped from him. He pictured the happy party jingling along snowy streets, the appearance of the limousine, the horrible public descent of him and Myra before 60 reproachful eyes. His apology, a real one this time. He sighed aloud. "What?" inquired Myra. "Nothing. I was just yawning. Are we going to, surely, catch up with them before they get there?" He was encouraging a faint hope that they might slip into the Minnehaha Club and meet the others there, be found in blasé seclusion before the fire, and quite regain his lost attitude. "Oh, sure, Mike, we'll catch him all right. Let's hurry." He became conscious of his stomach. As they stepped into the machine, he hurriedly slapped the paint of diplomacy over a rather box-like plan he had conceived. It was based upon some trade lasts gleaned at dancing school, to the effect that he was awfully good-looking and English, sort of. "Myra," he said, lowering his voice and choosing his words carefully, "I beg a thousand pardons. Can you ever forgive me?" She regarded him gravely, his intent green eyes, his mouth, that to her 13-year-old, arrow-collar taste was the quintessence of romance. Yes, Myra could forgive him very easily.
"Why, yes, sure."
He looked at her again, and then dropped his eyes. He had lashes. "I'm awful," he said sadly. "I'm different. I don't know why I make faux pas. Because I don't care, I suppose." then recklessly, "I've been smoking too much. I got tobacco heart." Myra pictured an all-night tobacco debauch, with Amory pale and reeling from the effect of nicotined lungs. She gave a little gasp.
"Oh, Amory, don't smoke! You'll stunt your growth!"
"I don't care," he persisted gloomily. "I gotta. I got the habit. I've done a lot of things that if my family knew—" He hesitated, giving her imagination time to picture dark horrors. "I went to the burlesque show last week." Myra was quite overcome. He turned the green eyes on her again. "You're the only girl in town I like much," he exclaimed in a rush of sentiment. "You're simpatico." Myra was not sure that she was, but it sounded stylish, though vaguely improper. Thick dusk had descended outside, and as the limousine made a sudden turn she was jolted against him. Their hands touched.
"You shouldn't smoke, Amory," she whispered. "Don't you know that?"
He shook his head. "Nobody cares." Myra hesitated.
"I care."
Something stirred within Amory. "Oh, yes, you do. You got a crush on Froggy Parker. I guess everybody knows that."
"No, I haven't,"
very slowly. A silence, while Amory thrilled. There was something fascinating about Myra, shut away here cozily from the dim, chill air. Myra, a little bundle of clothes with strands of yellow hair curling out from under her skating cap. "Because I've got a crush, too." He paused, for he heard in the distance the sound of young laughter, and peering through the frosted glass along the lamplit street, he made out the dark outline of the bobbing party. He must act quickly. He reached over with a violent, jerky effort and clutched Myra's hand, her thumb, to be exact. "Tell him to go to the Minnehaha straight," he whispered. "I want to talk to you. I got to talk to you." Myra made out the party ahead, had an instant vision of her mother, and then, alas for convention, glanced into the eyes beside.
"Turn down this side street, Richard, and drive straight to the Minnehaha Club," she cried through the speaking tube.
Amory sank back against the cushions with a sigh of relief.
"I can kiss her," he thought. "I'll bet I can. I'll bet I can."
Overhead the cliff was half crystalline, half misty, and the night around was chill and vibrant with rich tension. From the country club steps the road stretched away, dark creases on the white blanket, huge heaps of snow lining the sides like the tracks of giant moles. They lingered for a moment on the steps and watched the white holiday moon. "Pale moons like that one," Amory made a vague gesture, "make people mysterieuse. You look like a young witch with her cap off and her hair sort of mussed." Her hands clutched at her hair. "Oh, leave it. It looks good." They drifted up the stairs, and Myra led the way into a little den of his dreams, where a cozy fire was burning before a big sink-down couch. A few years later this was to be a great stage for Amory, a cradle for many an emotional crisis. Now they talked for a moment about bobbing parties. "There's always a bunch of shy fellas," he commented, "sitting at the tail of the bob, sort of lurkin' and whisperin' and pushin' each other off. Then there's always some crazy cross-eyed girl." He gave a terrifying imitation. "She's always talkin' hard, sort of, to the chaperone."
"You're such a funny boy," puzzled Myra.
"How do you mean?" Amory gave immediate attention, on his own ground at last.
"Oh, always talking about crazy things. Why don't you come skiing with Marilyn and I tomorrow?"
"I don't like girls in the daytime," he said shortly, and then, thinking this a bit abrupt, he added, "But I like you." He cleared his throat. "I like you first and second and third."
Myra's eyes became dreamy. What a story this would make to tell Marilyn! Here on the couch with this wonderful-looking boy, the little fire, the sense that they were alone in the great building. Myra capitulated. The atmosphere was too appropriate.
"I like you the first 25,"
she confessed, her voice trembling, "and Froggy Parker 26th. Froggy had fallen 25 places in 1 hour. As yet he had not even noticed it. But Amory, being on the spot, leaned over quickly and kissed Myra's cheek. He had never kissed a girl before, and he tasted his lips curiously, as if he had munched some new fruit. Then their lips brushed like young wild flowers in the wind.
"We're awful," rejoiced Myra gently.
She slipped her hand into his. Her head drooped against his shoulder. Sudden revulsion seized Amory, disgust, loathing for the whole incident. He desired frantically to be away, never to see Myra again, never to kiss anyone. He became conscious of his face and hers, of their clinging hands, and he wanted to creep out of his body, and hide somewhere safe, out of sight, up in the corner of his mind.
"Kiss me again?"
Her voice came out of a great void.
"I don't want to,"
he heard himself saying. There was another pause.
"I don't want to,"
he repeated passionately. Myra sprang up, her cheeks pink with bruised vanity, the great bow on the back of her head trembling sympathetically.
"I hate you," she cried. "Don't you ever dare speak to me again."
"What?" stammered Amory.
"I'll tell Mama you kissed me. I will, too. I will, too. I'll tell Mama, and she won't let me play with you."
Amory rose and stared at her helplessly, as though she were a new animal of whose presence on the earth he had not heretofore been aware. The door opened suddenly, and Myra's mother appeared on the threshold, fumbling with her lorgnette.
"Well," she began, adjusting it benignantly, "the man at the desk told me you two children were up here. How do you do, Amory?"
Amory watched Myra and waited for the crash, but none came. The pout faded, the high pink subsided, and Myra's voice was placid as a summer lake when she answered her mother.
"Oh, we started so late, Mama, that I thought we might as well—"
He heard from below the shrieks of laughter, and smelled the vapid odor of hot chocolate and tea cakes, as he silently followed mother and daughter downstairs. The sound of the gramophone mingled with the voices of many girls humming the air, and a faint glow was born and spread over him. Casey Jones mounted to the cabin, Casey Jones with his orders in his hand. Casey Jones mounted to the cabin, took his farewell journey to the promised land. End of Book One, Chapter One, Part One.
Snapshots of the Young Egotist. Amory spent nearly 2 years in Minneapolis. The first winter he wore moccasins that were born yellow, but after many applications of oil and dirt assumed their mature color, a dirty greenish-brown. He wore a gray plaid mackinaw coat and a red toboggan cap. His dog, Count Del Monte, ate the red cap, so his uncle gave him a gray one that pulled down over his face. The trouble with this one was that you breathed into it, and your breath froze. One day the darn thing froze his cheek. He rubbed snow on his cheek, but it turned bluish-black just the same. The Count Del Monte ate a box of bluing once, but it didn't hurt him. Later, however, he lost his mind, and ran madly up the street, bumping into fences, rolling in gutters, and pursuing his eccentric course out of Amory's life. Amory cried on his bed. "Poor little Count," he cried. "Oh, poor little Count!" After several months, he suspected Count of a fine piece of emotional acting. Amory and Frog Parker considered that the greatest line in literature occurred in Act Three of Arsène Lupin. They sat in the first row at the Wednesday and Saturday matinees. The line was, "If one can't be a great artist or a great soldier, the next best thing is to be a great criminal." Amory fell in love again and wrote a poem. This was it. "Marilyn and Sally, those are the girls for me. Marilyn stands above Sally in that sweet deep love." He was interested in whether McGovern of Minnesota would make the first or second All-American, how to do the card pass, how to do the coin pass, chameleon ties, how babies were born, and whether Three-Fingered Brown was really a better pitcher than Christy Mathewson. Among other things he read, "For the Honor of the School," "Little Women," twice, "The Common Law," "Sappho," "Dangerous Dan McGrew," "The Broad Highway," three times, "The Fall of the House of Usher," 3 weeks, "Mary Ware, the Little Colonel's Chum," "Gunga Din," "The Police Gazette," and "Jim Jam Gems." He had all the henty biases in history, and was particularly fond of the cheerful murder stories of Mary Roberts Reinhardt. School ruined his French and gave him a distaste for standard authors. His masters considered him idle, unreliable, and superficially clever. He collected locks of hair from many girls. He wore the rings of several. Finally, he could borrow no more rings, owing to his nervous habit of chewing them out of shape. This, it seemed, usually aroused the jealous suspicions of the next borrower. All through the summer months, Amory and Frog Parker went each week to the stock company. Afterward, they would stroll home in the balmy air of August night, dreaming along Hennepin and Nicolette Avenues, through the gay crowd. Amory wondered how people could fail to notice that he was a boy marked for glory, and when faces of the throng turned toward him, and ambiguous eyes stared into his, he assumed the most romantic of expressions, and walked on the air cushions that lie on the asphalts of 14. Always, after he was in bed, there were voices, indefinite, fading, enchanting, just outside his window, and before he fell asleep he would dream one of his favorite waking dreams, the one about becoming a great halfback, or the one about the Japanese invasion, when he was rewarded by being made the youngest general in the world. It was always the becoming he dreamed of, never the being. This, too, was quite characteristic of Amory. Code of the Young Egotist. Before he was summoned back to Lake Geneva, he had appeared, shy but inwardly glowing, in his first long trousers, set off by a purple accordion tie and a Belmont collar with the edges unassailably meeting, purple socks, and handkerchief with a purple border peeping from his breast pocket. But more than that, he had formulated his first philosophy, a code to live by which, as near as it can be named, was a sort of aristocratic egotism. He had realized that his best interests were bound up with those of a certain variant, changing person, whose label, in order that his past might always be identified with him, was Amory Blaine. Amory marked himself a fortunate youth, capable of infinite expansion for good or evil. He did not consider himself a strong character, but relied on his facility, learn things sorta quick, and his superior mentality, read a lot of deep books. He was proud of the fact that he could never become a mechanical or scientific genius. From no other heights was he debarred. Physically, Amory thought he was exceedingly handsome. He was. He fancied himself an athlete of possibilities and a supple dancer. Socially, here his condition was perhaps most dangerous. He granted himself personality, charm, magnetism, poise, the power of dominating all contemporary males, the gift of fascinating all women. Mentally, complete unquestioned superiority. Now a confession will have to be made. Amory had rather a Puritan conscience. Not that he yielded to it. Later in life he almost completely slew it. But at 15 it made him consider himself a great deal worse than other boys. Unscrupulousness. The desire to influence people in almost every way, even for evil. A certain coldness and lack of affection, amounting sometimes to cruelty. A shifting sense of honor. An unholy selfishness. A puzzled, furtive interest in everything concerning sex. There was also a curious strain of weakness running crosswise through his makeup. A harsh phrase from the lips of an older boy, older boys usually detested him, was liable to sweep him off his poise into surly sensitiveness or timid stupidity. He was a slave to his own moods, and he felt that though he was capable of recklessness and audacity, he possessed neither courage, perseverance, nor self-respect. Vanity, tempered with self-suspicion, if not self-knowledge, a sense of people as automatons to his will, a desire to pass as many boys as possible and get to a vague top of the world, with this background did Amory drift into adolescence, preparatory to the great adventure. The train slowed up with midsummer languor at Lake Geneva, and Amory caught sight of his mother waiting in her electric on the graveled station drive. It was an ancient electric, one of the early types, and painted gray. The sight of her sitting there, slenderly erect, and of her face, where beauty and dignity combined, melting to a dreamy, recollected smile, filled him with a sudden great pride of her. As they kissed coolly, and he stepped into the electric, he felt a quick fear lest he had lost the requisite charm to measure up to her. "Dear boy, you're so tall. Look behind and see if there's anything coming." She looked left and right. She slipped cautiously into a speed of 2 miles an hour, beseeching Amory to act as sentinel, and at one busy crossing she made him get out and run ahead to signal her forward like a traffic policeman. Beatrice was what might be termed a careful driver. "You are tall, but you're still very handsome. You've skipped the awkward age, or is that 16? Perhaps it's 14 or 15. I can never remember, but you've skipped it." "Don't embarrass me," murmured Amory. "But, my dear boy, what odd clothes! They look as if they were a set, don't they? Is your underwear purple, too?" Amory grunted impolitely. "You must go to Brooks and get some really nice suits. Oh, we'll have a talk tonight, or perhaps tomorrow night. I want to tell you about your heart. You've probably been neglecting your heart, and you don't know." Amory thought how superficial was the recent overlay of his own generation. Aside from a minute shyness, he felt that the old cynical kinship with his mother had not been one bit broken. Yet for the first few days he wandered about the gardens and along the shore in a state of super-loneliness, finding a lethargic content in smoking Bull at the garage with one of the chauffeurs. The 60 acres of the estate were dotted with old and new summer-houses and many fountains and white benches that came suddenly into sight from foliage-hung hiding-places. There was a great and constantly increasing family of white cats that prowled the many flower-beds and were silhouetted suddenly at night against the darkening trees. It was on one of the shadowy paths that Beatrice at last captured Amory, after Mr. Blaine had, as usual, retired for the evening to his private library. After reproving him for avoiding her, she took him for a long tête-à-tête in the moonlight. He could not reconcile himself to her beauty, that was mother to his own, the exquisite neck and shoulders, the grace of a fortunate woman of 30. "Amory, dear," she crooned softly, "I had such a strange, weird time after I left you."
"Did you, Beatrice?"
"When I had my last breakdown." She spoke of it as a sturdy, gallant feat. "The doctors told me," her voice sang on a confidential note, "that if any man alive had done the consistent drinking that I have, he would have been physically shattered, my dear, and in his grave, long in his grave." Amory winced, and wondered how this would have sounded to Froggy Parker. "Yes," continued Beatrice tragically, "I had dreams, wonderful visions." She pressed the palms of her hands into her eyes. "I saw bronze rivers lapping marble shores, and great birds that soared through the air, party-colored birds with iridescent plumage. I heard strange music and the flare of barbaric trumpets." "What?" Amory had snickered. "What, Amory?" "I said, go on, Beatrice." "That was all. It merely recurred and recurred. Gardens that flaunted colouring against which this would be quite dull. Moons that whirled and swayed, paler than winter moons, more golden than harvest moons." "Are you quite well now, Beatrice?" "Quite well as I will ever be. I am not understood, Amory. I know that can't express it to you, Amory, but I am not understood." Amory was quite moved. He put his arm around his mother, rubbing his head gently against her shoulder. "Poor Beatrice, poor Beatrice." "Tell me about you, Amory. Did you have two horrible years?" Amory considered lying, and then decided against it. "No, Beatrice, I enjoyed them. I adapted myself to the bourgeoisie. I became conventional." He surprised himself by saying that, and he pictured how Froggy would have gaped. "Beatrice," he said suddenly, "I want to go away to school. Everybody in Minneapolis is going to go away to school." "But you're only 15. "Yes, but everybody goes away to school at 15, and I want to, Beatrice." On Beatrice's suggestion, the subject was dropped for the rest of the walk, but a week later she delighted him by saying, "Amory, I have decided to let you have your way. If you still want to, you can go to school." "Yes?" "To St. Regis's, in Connecticut." Amory felt a quick excitement. "It's being arranged," continued Beatrice. "It's better that you should go away. I'd have preferred you to have gone to Eton, and then to Christchurch, Oxford, but it seems impracticable now, and for the present we'll let the university question take care of itself." "What are you going to do, Beatrice?" "Heaven knows. It seems my fate to fret away my years in this country. Not for a second do I regret being American. Indeed, I think that a regret typical of very vulgar people, and I feel sure we are the great coming nation. Yet," and she sighed, "I feel my life should have drowsed away close to an older, mellower civilization, a land of greens and autumnal browns." Amory did not answer, so his mother continued. "My regret is that you haven't been abroad, but still, as you are a man, it's better that you should grow up here under the snarling eagle. Is that the right term?" Amory agreed that it was. She would not have appreciated the Japanese invasion. "When do I go to school?" "Next month. You'll have to start east a little early to take your examinations. After that, you'll have a free week, so I want you to go up the Hudson and pay a visit." "To who?" "To Monsignor Darcy, Amory. He wants to see you. He went to Harrow and then to Yale, became a Catholic. I want him to talk to you. I feel he can be such a help." She stroked his auburn hair gently. "Dear Amory, dear Amory." "Dear Beatrice." So, early in September, Amory, provided with 6 suits summer underwear, 6 suits winter underwear, 1 sweater or t-shirt, 1 jersey, 1 overcoat, winter, etc., set out for New England, the land of schools. There were Andover and Exeter with their memories of New England dead, large, college-like democracies, St. Mark's, Groton, St. Regis, recruited from Boston and the Knickerbocker families of New York, St. Paul's with its great rinks, Pomfret and St. George's, prosperous and well-dressed, Taft and Hotchkiss, which prepared the wealth of the Middle West for social success at Yale, Pawling, Westminster, Choate, Kent, and 100 others, all milling out their well-set-up, conventional, impressive type, year after year. Their mental stimulus, the college entrance exams,
their vague purpose set forth in 100 circulars as "to impart a thorough mental, moral, and physical training as a Christian gentleman, to fit the boy for meeting the problems of his day and generation, and to give a solid foundation in the arts and sciences." At St. Regis's, Amory stayed 3 days and took his exams with a scoffing confidence, then doubling back to New York to pay his tutelary visit. The metropolis, barely glimpsed, made little impression on him except for the sense of cleanliness he drew from the tall white buildings seen from a Hudson River steamboat in the early morning. Indeed, his mind was so crowded with dreams of athletic prowess at school that he considered this visit only as a rather tiresome prelude to the great adventure. This, however, it did not prove to be. Monsignor Darcy's house was an ancient rambling structure set on a hill overlooking the river, and there lived its owner between his trips to all parts of the Roman Catholic world, rather like an exiled Stuart king waiting to be called to the rule of his land. Monsignor was 44 then, and bustling, a trifle too stout for symmetry, with hair the color of spun gold and a brilliant, enveloping personality. When he came into a room clad in his full purple regalia from thatch to toe, he resembled a Turner sunset, and attracted both admiration and attention. He had written 2 novels, one of them violently anti-Catholic, just before his conversion, and 5 years later another, in which he had attempted to turn all his clever jibes against Catholics into even cleverer innuendos against Episcopalians. He was intensely ritualistic, startlingly dramatic, loved the idea of God enough to be a celibate, and rather liked his neighbor. Children adored him because he was like a child. Youth reveled in his company because he was still a youth and couldn't be shocked. In the proper land and century he might have been a Richelieu. At present he was a very moral, very religious, if not particularly pious, clergyman, making a great mystery about pulling rusty wires, and appreciating life to the fullest, if not entirely enjoying it. He and Amory took to each other at first sight, the jovial, impressive prelate who could dazzle an embassy ball, and the green-eyed, intent youth in his first long trousers, accepted in their own minds a relation of father and son within a half-hour's conversation. "My dear boy, I've been waiting to see you for years. Take a big chair, and we'll have a chat." "I've just come from school, St. Regis's, you know." "So your mother says. A remarkable woman. Have a cigarette. I'm sure you smoke. Well, if you're like me, you loathe all science and mathematics." Amory nodded vehemently. "Hate 'em all, like English and history." "Of course. You'll hate school for a while, too, but I'm glad you're going to St. Regis's."
"Why?"
"Because it's a gentleman's school, and democracy won't hit you so early. You'll find plenty of that in college."
"I want to go to Princeton," said Amory. "I don't know why, but I think of all Harvard men as sissies, like I used to be, and all Yale men as wearing big blue sweaters and smoking pipes."
Monsignor chuckled. "I'm one, you know."
"Oh, you're different. I think of Princeton as being lazy and good-looking and aristocratic, you know, like a spring day. Harvard seems sort of indoors."
"And Yale is November, crisp and energetic," finished Monsignor.
"That's it."
They slipped briskly into an intimacy from which they never recovered. "I was for Bonnie Prince Charlie," announced Amory.
"Of course you were. And for Hannibal."
"Yes, and for the Southern Confederacy." He was rather skeptical about being an Irish patriot. He suspected that being Irish was being somewhat common, but Monsignor assured him that Ireland was a romantic lost cause, and Irish people quite charming, and that it should, by all means, be one of his principal biases. After a crowded hour, which included several more cigarettes, and during which Monsignor learned, to his surprise but not to his horror, that Amory had not been brought up a Catholic, he announced that he had another guest. This turned out to be the Honorable Thornton Hancock of Boston, ex-minister to The Hague, author of an erudite history of the Middle Ages, and the last of a distinguished, patriotic, and brilliant family.
"He comes here for a rest," said Monsignor confidentially, treating Amory as a contemporary. "I act as an escape from the weariness of agnosticism, and I think I'm the only man who knows how his staid old mind is really at sea, and longs for a sturdy spar like the church to cling to." Their first luncheon was one of the memorable events of Amory's early life. He was quite radiant, and gave off a peculiar brightness and charm. Monsignor called out the best that he had thought by question and suggestion, and Amory talked with an ingenious brilliance of a thousand impulses and desires and repulsions and faiths and fears. He and Monsignor held the floor, and the older man, with his less receptive, less accepting, yet certainly not colder mentality, seemed content to listen and bask in the mellow sunshine that played between these two. Monsignor gave the effect of sunlight to many people. Amory gave it in his youth, and, to some extent, when he was very much older. But never again was it quite so mutually spontaneous. "He's a radiant boy," thought Thornton Hancock, who had seen the splendor of two continents, and talked with Parnell and Gladstone and Bismarck, and afterward he added to Monsignor, "But his education ought not to be entrusted to a school or college." But for the next 4 years the best of Amory's intellect was concentrated on matters of popularity, the intricacies of a university social system, and American society as represented by Biltmore Teas and Hot Springs Golf Links. In all, a wonderful week that saw Amory's mind turned inside out, 100 of his theories confirmed, and his joy of life crystallized to 1,000 ambitions. Not that the conversation was scholastic, heaven forbid. Amory had only the vaguest idea as to what Bernard Shaw was, but Monsignor made quite as much out of The Beloved Vagabond and Sir Nigel, taking good care that Amory never once felt out of his depth. But the trumpets were sounding for Amory's preliminary skirmish with his own generation. "You're not sorry to go, of course. With people like us, our home is where we are not," said Monsignor. "I am sorry." "No, you're not. No one person in the world is necessary to you or to me." "Well, goodbye." End of Book One, Chapter One, Part Two. Read by Kara Schallenberg, www.kray.org, on September 21st, 2006, in Oceanside, California.
The Egotist Down. Amory's 2 years at St. Regis's, though in turn painful and triumphant, had as little real significance in his own life as the American prep school, crushed as it is under the heel of the universities, has to American life in general. We have no Eton to create the self-consciousness of a governing class. We have instead clean, flaccid, and innocuous preparatory schools. He went all wrong at the start, was generally considered both conceited and arrogant, and universally detested. He played football intensely, alternating a reckless brilliancy with a tendency to keep himself as safe from hazard as decency would permit. In a wild panic he backed out of a fight with a boy his own size to a chorus of scorn, and a week later, in desperation, picked a battle with another boy, very much bigger, from which he emerged badly beaten, but rather proud of himself. He was resentful against all those in authority over him, and this, combined with a lazy indifference toward his work, exasperated every master in school. He grew discouraged and imagined himself a pariah, took to sulking in corners and reading after lights. With the dread of being alone, he attached a few friends, but since they were not among the elite of the school, he used them simply as mirrors of himself, audiences before which he might do that posing absolutely essential to him. He was unbearably lonely, desperately unhappy. There were some few grains of comfort. Whenever Amory was submerged, his vanity was the last part to go below the surface, so he could still enjoy a comfortable glow when Wookie Wookie, the deaf old housekeeper, told him that he was the best-looking boy she had ever seen. It had pleased him to be the lightest and youngest man on the first football squad. It pleased him when Dr. Dougal told him at the end of a heated conference that he could, if he wished, get the best marks in school. But Dr. Dougal was wrong. It was temperamentally impossible for Amory to get the best marks in school. Miserable, confined to bounds, unpopular with both faculty and students, that was Amory's first term. But at Christmas he had returned to Minneapolis, tight-lipped and strangely jubilant. "Oh, I was sort of fresh at first," he told Frog Parker patronizingly, "but I got along fine. Lightest man on the squad. You ought to go away to school, Froggy. It's great stuff." Incident of the Well-Meaning Professor. On the last night of his first term, Mr. Margerson, the senior master, sent word to study hall that Amory was to come to his room at 9. Amory suspected that advice was forthcoming, but he determined to be courteous, because this Mr. Margerson had been kindly disposed toward him. His summoner received him gravely and motioned him to a chair. He hemmed several times and looked consciously kind, as a man will when he knows he's on delicate ground. "Amory," he began, "I've sent for you on a personal matter." "Yes, sir." "I've noticed you this year, and I like you. I think you have in you the makings of a very good man." "Yes, sir," Amory managed to articulate. He hated having people talk as if he were an admitted failure. "But I've noticed," continued the older man blindly, "that you're not very popular with the boys." "No, sir." Amory licked his lips. "Ah, I thought you might not understand exactly what it was they, objected to. I'm going to tell you because I believe, that when a boy knows his difficulties, he's better able to cope with them, to conform to what others expect of him." He ahemmed again with delicate reticence and continued, "They seem to think that you're, rather too fresh." Amory could stand no more. He rose from his chair, scarcely controlling his voice when he spoke. "I know. Oh, don't you suppose I know?" His voice rose. "I know what they think. Do you suppose you have to tell me?" He paused. I've got to go back now. Hope I'm not rude." He left the room hurriedly. In the cold air outside, as he walked to his house, he exulted in his refusal to be helped. "That damn old fool!" he cried wildly. "As if I didn't know!" He decided, however, that this was a good excuse not to go back to study hall that night, so, comfortably couched up in his room, he munched Nabiscos and finished The White Company. Incident of the Wonderful Girl. There was a bright star in February. New York burst upon him on Washington's birthday with the brilliance of a long-anticipated event. His glimpse of it as a vivid whiteness against a deep blue sky had left a picture of splendor that rivaled the dream cities in the Arabian Nights, but this time he saw it by electric light, and romance gleamed from the chariot race sign on Broadway and from the women's eyes at the Astor, where he and young Paskert from St. Regis's had dinner. When they walked down the aisle of the theater, greeted by the nervous twanging and discord of untuned violins and the sensuous heavy fragrance of paint and powder, he moved in a sphere of Epicurean delight. Everything enchanted him. The play was The Little Millionaire with George M. Cohan, and there was one stunning young brunette who made him sit with brimming eyes in the ecstasy of watching her dance. "Oh, you wonderful girl, what a wonderful girl you are," sang the tenor, and Amory agreed silently, but passionately. "All your wonderful words thrill me through." The violin swelled and quavered on the last notes. The girl sank to a crumpled butterfly on the stage. A great burst of clapping filled the house. Oh, to fall in love like that, to the languorous magic melody of such a tune. The last scene was laid on a roof garden, and the cellos sighed to the musical moon, while light adventure and facile froth-like comedy flitted back and forth in the calcium. Amory was on fire to be a habitué of roof gardens, to meet a girl who should look like that, better, that very girl, whose hair would be drenched with golden moonlight, while at his elbow sparkling wine was poured by an unintelligible waiter. When the curtain fell for the last time, he gave such a long sigh that the people in front of him twisted around and stared and said loud enough for him to hear, "What a remarkable-looking boy!" This took his mind off the play, and he wondered if he really did seem handsome to the population of New York. Paskert and he walked in silence toward their hotel. The former was the first to speak. His uncertain 15-year-old voice broke in a melancholy strain on Amory's musings. "I'd marry that girl tonight." There was no need to ask what girl he referred to. "I'd be proud to take her home and introduce her to my people," continued Paskert. Amory was distinctly impressed. He wished he had said it instead of Paskert. It sounded so mature. "I wonder about actresses. Are they all pretty bad?" "No, sir, not by a darn sight," said the worldly youth with emphasis. "And I know that girl's as good as gold. I can tell." They wandered on, mixing in the Broadway crowd, dreaming on the music that eddied out of the cafes. New faces flashed on and off like myriad lights, pale or rouged faces, tired yet sustained by a weary excitement. Amory watched them in fascination. He was planning his life. He was going to live in New York and be known at every restaurant and cafe, wearing a dress suit from early evening to early morning, sleeping away the dull hours of the forenoon. "Yes, sir, I'd marry that girl tonight." Heroic in general tone. October of his second and last year at St. Regis's was a high point in Amory's memory. The game with Groton was played from 3 of a snappy, exhilarating afternoon, far into the crisp autumnal twilight, and Amory, at quarterback, exhorting in wild despair, making impossible tackles, calling signals in a voice that had diminished to a hoarse, furious whisper, yet found time to revel in the blood-stained bandage around his head, and the straining, glorious heroism of plunging, crashing bodies and aching limbs. For those minutes, courage flowed like wine out of the November dusk, and he was the eternal hero, one with the sea rover on the prow of a Norse galley, one with Roland and Horatius, Sir Nigel and Ted Coy, scraped and stripped into trim, and then flung by his own will into the breach, beating back the tide, hearing from afar the thunder of cheers, finally bruised and weary, but still elusive, circling an end, twisting, changing pace, straight-arming, falling behind the Groton goal with two men on his legs, in the only touchdown of the game. The Philosophy of the Slicker. From the scoffing superiority of sixth-form year and success, Amory looked back with cynical wonder on his status of the year before. He was changed as completely as Amory Blaine could ever be changed. Amory plus Beatrice plus 2 years in Minneapolis, these had been his ingredients when he entered St. Regis's. But the Minneapolis years were not a thick enough overlay to conceal the Amory plus Beatrice from the ferreting eyes of a boarding school, so St. Regis's had very painfully drilled Beatrice out of him, and begun to lay down new and more conventional planking on the fundamental Amory. But both St. Regis's and Amory were unconscious of the fact that this fundamental Amory had not in himself changed. Those qualities for which he had suffered, his moodiness, his tendency to pose, his laziness, and his love of playing the fool, were now taken as a matter of course, recognized eccentricities in a star quarterback, a clever actor, and the editor of the St. Regis Tattler. It puzzled him to see impressionable small boys imitating the very vanities that had not long ago been contemptible weaknesses. After the football season, he slumped into dreamy content. The night of the pre-holiday dance, he slipped away and went early to bed for the pleasure of hearing the violin music cross the grass and come surging in at his window. Many nights he lay there dreaming awake of secret cafes in Montmartre, where ivory women delved in romantic mysteries with diplomats and soldiers of fortune, while orchestras played Hungarian waltzes, and the air was thick and exotic with intrigue and moonlight and adventure. In the spring he read L'Allegro by request, and was inspired to lyrical outpourings on the subject of Arcady and the pipes of Pan. He moved his bed so that the sun would wake him at dawn, that he might dress and go out to the archaic swing that hung from an apple tree near the sixth form house. Seating himself in this, he would pump higher and higher until he got the effect of swinging into the wide air, into a fairyland of piping satyrs and nymphs, with the faces of fair-haired girls he passed in the streets of Eastchester. As the swing reached its highest point, Arcady really lay just over the brow of a certain hill, where the brown road dwindled out of sight in a golden dot. He read voluminously all spring, the beginning of his 18th year, The Gentleman from Indiana, The New Arabian Nights, The Morals of Marcus Ordine, The Man Who Was Thursday, which he liked without understanding, Stover at Yale, that became somewhat of a textbook, Dombey and Son, because he thought he really should read better stuff, Robert Chambers, David Graham Phillips, and E. Phillips Oppenheim, complete, and a scattering of Tennyson and Kipling. Of all his classwork, only L'Allegro, and some quality of rigid clarity and solid geometry, stirred his languid interest. As June drew near, he felt the need of conversation to formulate his own ideas, and, to his surprise, found a co-philosopher in Rahill, the president of the sixth form. In many a talk, on the high road, or lying belly down along the edge of the baseball diamond, or late at night with their cigarettes glowing in the dark, they threshed out the questions of school, and there was developed the term slicker. "Got tobacco?" whispered Rahill one night, putting his head inside the door 5 minutes after lights. "Sure. I'm coming in. Take a couple of pillows and lie in the window seat, why don't you?" Amory sat up in bed and lit a cigarette, while Rahill settled for a conversation. Rahill's favorite subject was the respective futures of the sixth form, and Amory never tired of outlining them for his benefit. "Ted Converse? That's easy. He'll fail his exams, tutor all summer at Harstrom's, get into chef with about 4 conditions, and flunk out in the middle of the freshman year. Then he'll go back west and raise hell for a year or so. Finally his father will make him go into the paint business. He'll marry and have 4 sons, all boneheads. He'll always think St. Regis has spoiled him, so he'll send his sons to day school in Portland. He'll die of locomotor ataxia when he's 41, and his wife will give a baptizing stand, or whatever you call it, to the Presbyterian Church, with his name on it. Hold up, Amory, that's too darn gloomy. How about yourself? I'm in a superior class. You are, too. We're philosophers." "I'm not." "Sure you are. You've got a darn good head on you." But Amory knew that nothing in the abstract, no theory or generality, ever moved Rahill until he stubbed his toe upon the concrete minutiae of it. "Haven't," insisted Rahill. "I let people impose on me here, and don't get anything out of it. I'm the prey of my friends, damn it. Do their lessons, get 'em out of trouble, pay 'em stupid summer visits, and always entertain their kid sisters. Keep my temper when they get selfish, and then they think they pay me back by voting for me and telling me I'm the big man of St. Regis's. I want to get where everybody does their own work, and I can tell people where to go. I'm tired of being nice to every poor fish in school." "You're not a slicker," said Amory suddenly. "A what?" "A slicker. What the devil's that?" "Well, it's something that... there's a lot of them. You're not one, and neither am I, though I am more than you are." "Who is one? What makes you one?" Amory considered. Why, I suppose that the sign of it is when a fellow slicks his hair back with water." "Like Carstairs?" "Yes, sure. He's a slicker." They spent 2 evenings getting an exact definition. The slicker was good-looking or clean-looking. He had brains, social brains, that is, and he used all means on the broad path of honesty to get ahead, be popular, admired, and never in trouble. He dressed well, was particularly neat in appearance, and derived his name from the fact that his hair was inevitably worn short, soaked in water or tonic, parted in the middle, and slicked back as the current of fashion dictated. The slickers of that year had adopted tortoiseshell spectacles as badges of their slickerhood, and this made them so easy to recognize that Amory and Rahill never missed one. The slicker seemed distributed through school, always a little wiser and shrewder than his contemporaries, managing some team or other, and keeping his cleverness carefully concealed. Amory found the slicker a most valuable classification until his junior year in college, when the outline became so blurred and indeterminate that it had to be subdivided many times, and became only a quality. Amory's secret ideal had all the slicker qualifications, but, in addition, courage and tremendous brains and talents. Also, Amory conceded him a bizarre streak that was quite irreconcilable to the slicker proper. This was the first real break from the hypocrisy of school tradition. The slicker was a definite element of success, differing intrinsically from the prep school big man. The slicker. 1. Clever sense of social values. 2. Dresses well, pretends the dress is superficial, but knows that it isn't. 3. Goes into such activities as he can shine in. 4. Gets to college and is, in a worldly way, successful. 5. Hair slicked. The big man. 1. Inclined to stupidity and unconscious of social values. 2. Thinks dress is superficial and is inclined to be careless about it. 3. Goes out for everything from a sense of duty. 4. Gets to college and has a problematical future, feels lost without his circle, and always says that school days were happiest after all. Goes back to school and makes speeches about what St. Regis's boys are doing. 5. Hair not slicked. Amory had decided definitely on Princeton, even though he would be the only boy entering that year from St. Regis's. Yale had a romance and glamour from the tales of Minneapolis, and St. Regis's men who had been tapped for Skull and Bones, but Princeton drew him most, with its atmosphere of bright colors and its alluring reputation as the pleasantest country club in America. Dwarfed by the menacing college exams, Amory's school days drifted into the past. Years afterward, when he went back to St. Regis's, he seemed to have forgotten the successes of sixth form year, and to be able to picture himself only as the unadjustable boy who had hurried down corridors, jeered at by his rabid contemporaries, mad with common sense. End of Book 1, Chapter 1, Part 3.